Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. My name is Erin Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And I'm Bob Martin.
We are here with our guest, Lauren Spivak. Say hi, Lauren.
Hi. How you doing?
Hi.
I never know I was supposed to say hi at that point.
I was directing you with my eyes.
We're not like other shows.
No. Other shows, they try to be all professional and, you know.
Yeah, that's boring.
It's stupid. We're all about the... We're kind of like NASCAR, you know? You always sit in turn four because that's where all the wrecks are. Just makes it more fun.
Well, it's just the place that I wanted to be.
Exactly. So. Lauren is the free market warrior. He was born and raised in Massachusetts, spent most of his adult life in New York City, neither of which we will hold against you. Before becoming active in politics, he worked for several nonprofits as a management consultant for both profit and nonprofit companies. He founded Free Market Warrior in 2009 in an effort to make a positive difference in American politics and economics. And although we're not going to discuss them in depth today, he has three terrific books that are loads of fun. Very educational, but loads of fun. The New Democrat, which is a parody on The Cat in the Hat. Oh, wait.
And a parody of the Obama years.
Yes, the Obama years and Salon.com. We can't forget the review. The most twisted piece of conservative propaganda print out there.
I love that.
A badge of honor.
Gotta like that.
Lest you think I don't get good reviews.
Yeah, just in case. You know, it's always good when your enemies are after you. And then The Gorax, which was a kind of, it's not really a spoof exactly, but it was a parody on The Lorax, and it's all about the...
It's an anti-environmentalist parody. It's about, it has Al Gore as The Lorax, and it's about how the environmentalists are destroying our country.
Exactly. And they are. And continue, so the book will be popular forever. Third book, The Wizard of Iz, is a parody of the Democrats. And for those of you that are still irritated with Hillary, as we all should be forever, she is actually the witch. And the illustrations on all of these are incredible and amazing.
When did that book come out, Lauren?
The Wizard of Iz?
Yes.
The first edition of The Wizard of Iz came out... Was it last year? What is this? This way, it came out in late 2015.
Okay.
This is already updated. It's the second edition, and it gets into a lot of things. You never mentioned the cowardly rhino.
No, the cowardly rhino was terrific, and he's John
Boehner. The cowardly lion has been replaced by the cowardly rhino, who suspects the Democrats are up to no good, but he's scared to do anything about it. He's looking for the courage to do something useful when he gets to Washington.
And Clinton is the wizard.
Bill Clinton is the wizard
who runs around in his boxer shorts the whole time,
and is all full of baloney. I think the cowardly rhino of all three books, I think my single best character is the cowardly rhino's. You know, in my judgment, I just think he just came out perfectly.
Yeah, he did.
If you look, he has the exact right thing to say in every single scene that just works perfectly, I think.
And he's just like the Cowardly Lion, for those of you who like the original scene.
And where can you pick those books up?
Well, the website is Dr. Truth Books, which is drtruthbooks, all one word, .com. And they make awesome gifts for, you know, conservative people if you happen to know any.
They do. And you might even slip them to your other family members that maybe are on the fence.
Yeah. Or you want them to, like, stop talking to you for a while.
Exactly. They could be a breakup gift.
That's right.
Yeah. They are a terrific read, though. They're very entertaining.
All right. So we're giving the book short shrift because we only have Lauren for an hour, and we wanted to talk about democracy. The hated democracy. So
yeah, the good and the bad.
Yeah. But you had said that whenever you tell people that you dislike democracy, they get all mad.
Well, yeah, there's an idea that if you don't like democracy, then you must like dictatorship. Because the way, you know, we've discussed previously, you know, the failures of the educational system, and the failures of the educational system, you know, is such that people think that there's two options. You either want democracy or you want Hitler.
Or you want something bad.
Yeah, those are your two choices. And that really is not true at all. Democracy is a system in which the majority tells the minority what to do. And I have a great deal of trouble with that. I don't think that that majorities understand what they ought to do themselves very well, let alone what other people should do.
You could also call that mob rule.
Well, it is. I mean, I was trying to think of what the difference was between a democracy and a mob rule. And the only difference I can tell is if you're part of the mob, if the mob is your has on your side, then that's democracy. And if the mob's on the other side, it's mob rule. But it's very you know questionable, and we tend to assume, you know, if you wanted to think of everything that I do and every talk I've given to everybody everywhere, which is a whole lot of talks, what I always try to do is go to the underlying assumption that's wrong somewhere at the base. I try not to prune the branches. I try to go right down to the roots and figure out what the root issue here, and the assumption that democracy is just inherently good and right, and that, you know, 51% of the people, you know, just have the God-given right to tell the other 49% what to do, is highly questionable. And I'm not interested in a dictatorship either. A dictatorship is, you know, one person, you know, telling everybody else what to do, and I don't want that either. There is a very good alternative to democracy that's right at our fingertips, and it's called capitalism. And people say to me, well, that's an economic system, and democracy is a political system, so you're comparing apples and oranges. And I disagree. It is not apples and oranges, because in both cases, you know, the issue is, in any society anywhere, whatever your system of government is, the issue in any society is, what are we going to do with the stuff that we have? You know, we've got resources, we've got people, we've got buildings and factories and natural resources, we've got a bunch of things. What are we going to do with them? And the dictatorship answer is the dictator decides what everything is good, what's going to be going to be done with everything. The democracy is that the 51% tell the 49% what to do with their stuff. And the capitalist model is that everyone decides for their own resources. And, you know, so my money that I've earned and my property that I own, I get to decide, and you get to decide for yours. And the only kind, and the interaction, and interactions happen all the time, and they're great, are voluntary interactions. If there's some business deal where it makes you happy and it makes me happy and we're both benefiting, then that's great. But neither of us ought to have the power to use government to force things down other people's throats. And it has several advantages. First of all, on the smaller scale, individual people are far more likely to understand all the ins and outs of their resources and able to make wiser decisions about the land they own, the money they have, etc., than somebody, you know, than a bunch of congressmen in Washington deciding how to appropriately utilize my land, you know, on the other side of the country. You know, how do they possibly know that?
Sure.
They make some general rule for everybody. I am and you too. I don't mean myself personally. I mean everybody is a much better custodian of their own property and their own money than anybody else is. You know, who spends other people's money as wisely as they spend their own money? You know, that's where we go. When I was in business, I remember I used to, you know, I would sign off on things we had to pay, and, you know, there would be a bill from the, you know, the phone company for, you know, $17,000. And I like, all right, there we go. I signed it. Next bill. And, you know, if it's my bill at my house and it's, you know, and it's 50 cents too high.
We're turning some lights off.
I'm going through the roof. I'm like calling them up and screaming at them because they got it off by 50 cents. Everybody treats their own money much more intelligently than they treat other people's money. It's just natural. And so because finally what it leads to is you've got an incentive.
Sure.
If I treat my property well and I use it wisely and I maintain it, and then that's good for me in the long run. When somebody else is doing this, particularly people I've never met from thousands of miles away who know nothing about what's going on here and frankly don't really care about the specific issues in my life and my family and my property and my kids. I'll throw my kids in there too, because I think I should decide how my kids get educated, not the state, not democracy. So, it's a highly flawed system because of that. And I'll tell you, I know you like to link books on your website. I will suggest one, if I may, which is called Democracy, The God That Failed, by Hans Hermann Hoppe. And it's a fascinating book, which, you know, gets into some details about, you know, what I believe also, that democracy does not work very well. And he makes some fascinating points, one of which is he suggests that in some ways monarchy works better than democracy. And his logic is like this, that the monarch owns the country. I mean, that's what the feudalistic model of monarchy is. If you're the king of England in 1400, you own England. It is your personal property. And everyone kind of works for you. And then when you die, you pass it on to your kid. And he becomes the new king of England. And the reason this may work better is that because of this, you have every incentive to keep the country as strong and prosperous as possible. Not only during your life, because you want a happy, prosperous kingdom, because that puts you higher up, but also you want to pass it on to your kids.
Sure.
The same reason I would take care of my house that I'm planning to pass on to my kids. I care about my kids. I want them to have a nice house.
Have a nice house.
So, in democracy, what happens? Well, one party gets elected and they come into power. And do they have an incentive to preserve things for the long run? No. They have an incentive to loot everything they can in the short run because they know they're not going to be there forever. They know that they're going to boot it out of office sooner or later, and they spend all the government money they possibly can on all their friends and get whatever they get to that's in their interest, that's not in the long term interest of the country. And then you would say, well, the other party has an incentive to call everyone's attention to this and say, look what they're doing.
But they don't, because they're making plans of their own.
But they don't. That's right, because they know that they're going to be in there next. It's going to be their turn to loot. And the last thing they want to do is you know, call attention to the looting.
Cool. Funny how that works.
Yep.
All right, we're going to chat more about this in a couple of minutes. We'll have a little capitalistic celebration right now for 2 minutes.
Okay.
We forgot to do celebration of capitalism. We just had Lauren on the show. So please check the website, and you can catch up with all his other ideas, because we've had some great times with him. The site is wethepeopleradio.us. So we should be talking about Illinois freedom. Those guys are in deep trouble.
There's a failure of democracy right there, by the way. You know, that people can vote to spend more and more money, and they don't really want to vote to get to tax themselves, you know, as much as they want to spend the money.
Right.
And so you have an inevitable kind of, you know, descent into debt.
Sure. And, well, they vote all these high pensions and...
Sure.
I mean, we're seeing that here in our local area.
And who could be against that?
Right. Give everybody more.
And the governor has every incentive to give, you know, whatever the unions want, because they're a huge political force. The union, yep. If the governor gives the union what it wants, then the union will get all their people voting for the governor.
Well, and I guess in Illinois, the governor is actually... has been advocating all these cuts.
This current governor, yes.
What's happening right now. I guess he's been advocating. I haven't been following their politics that much, but I was listening to a thing
this morning.
But
we're living in the wake of a bunch of other governors.
Correct.
Most of whom, if I understand correctly, are still living in state-owned housing. The former governors of Illinois.
Pretty good gig if you can get it, huh?
They're in prison.
The
prisons of Illinois filled with former governors.
Nice.
So they go from one government house.
Okay, that's not a good gig.
That's not a good gig.
To another government house.
Well, they apparently the speaker of the legislature there in Illinois, it's like the longest serving speaker, I don't know, in history or something like that. So that guy's just like, yep, nope, we're not gonna cut anything. So that's real nice. Yep, we're going broke. Well, we don't care. Hit the gas! I don't see it. Well, you were talking about the monarchy, so go back on the monarchy there.
Well, it's the idea that we assume that a show of hands, you know, is the best way to determine smart policy, and it's really not, because people can individually. Usually, I'm not saying, first of all, humans are never perfect. Let's be clear here. We all human beings will screw up from time to time. That's just absolutely inevitable. But so the issue is not perfection, which is, by the way, a huge argument we have with the socialists, because the socialists think that once the right guy gets in there,
perfection
will have arrived.
Mm-hmm.
And that's never going to arrive, because human beings are never perfect. And what socialists always do is they point to some imperfection in capitalism. They say, well, yeah, sure, people are 2,000 times richer than they were 200 years ago, but that guy is poorer than his neighbor, so therefore the whole capitalist system has to go out the window, and we have to put Bernie Sanders in charge of everybody's life because that guy, you know, doesn't make enough money. And so that's a game that they play. But we make decisions way better on the individual level than we do on the collective level, largely because of two things. One is our ability to comprehend. You know, our brain is not designed to understand 350 million people and all their needs and wants and jobs and activities and dreams for the future. It's impossible. And so you know, even if you're trying to get everybody what they want, okay, you don't know what everybody wants, and neither do I, and neither does anybody else who thinks themselves fit to run the society. But what we do know is our own life, what we want and what our dreams and our plans are, what we'd like to do with our property. And it works so much better when you decentralize that, which is what capitalism is. It's a decentralized system. And then what's next? Well, the next question people ask me is, well, are we going to have any laws at all? And this is very important. I think we ought to have laws, but we don't need new laws. And that's a huge difference. There are some basic things that need to be against the law, and they were all against the law hundreds of years ago. Murder needs to be against the law. Stealing stuff and assaulting people needs to be against the law. These are very clear-cut. It's also worth noting that they are non-controversial. In fact, one of my pet proposals to improve our current system, you know, incrementally, is I think that Congress should not pass any laws at all without a two-thirds majority. It shouldn't just be for overriding vetoes. I think if you can't get two-thirds in both chambers, you don't make the law at all. And I do that in the state legislature level, too. And if we did that, what would happen? Well, we'd still have laws against murder and robbery, because they'd get nine, you know, who? Do you know one single congressman who would not vote to make murder and robbery illegal? Okay, you'd have no problem with that at all. But you wouldn't get things like Obamacare, which are trying to micromanage everybody's life in the whole country. And why will that not happen? Because we shouldn't do that. We should leave people alone to make their own decisions. So requiring a supermajority for anything would actually greatly slow down the legislation process, which is good. It's what our founding fathers wanted, was slower legislation. But also, it will allow the obvious things to go that we really need, that have always been there, to go through. Hayek says something fascinating. Friedrich Hayek is another person I quote a lot. He says that legislatures don't make laws at all. He says that's not what law is. His is a misnomer. He says that's really just legislation. He said what comes out of legislatures is legislation. Laws are something that are built in to the nature of being human, Hayek says. And he says, we don't make laws, we discover them. In other words, the process of human history is a process of discovering what laws a society needs to have. Because the society that stumbles across a wise and prudent and limited set of laws that is enough to make peace at home but not stifle creativity, right? That's what we want.
Mm-hmm.
That society will grow and prosper and thrive. And societies that either don't have the appropriate laws because they let people go around killing each other, or they have way too many laws, laws and are oppressive and stifle creativity, those societies are going to die, and the superior societies are going to live. Sorry to offend your politically correct listeners, but the better societies will survive and thrive and pass these ideas along, and societies that aren't so well organized will fall by the wayside. So there is a process of discovery. You know, the whole concept of how we handle, and I'm a huge admirer of it, by the way, the whole way we handle criminal justice, you know, that you're entitled to a lawyer, that you're entitled to a trial by jury, that you have, you're entitled to question witnesses against you. You know, this is really good stuff, and it's a very, very good, in fact, I would say brilliant, concept we have to get as, you know, because human beings are never going to know for sure. You know, we can't read somebody's mind and know whether he's innocent or guilty. We can't, you know, we don't have a crystal ball to look into. But it's a very good, excellent system for figuring out who's guilty and who's innocent and applying the punishments appropriately. Well, that system, nobody just snapped their fingers and put that into effect. That system was the process of literally thousands of years of societal evolution, going back to the earliest Norman kings in England. It was what's his name? Henry II was the first, you know, a person who really developed the concept of jury trial in Britain, and it evolved in Britain and evolved in the United States. You know, fairly, you know there have been fairly recent details, you know, that have been added onto it. Some of which, you know, look pretty good. Some of which are more questionable. But it's a long term process, and that works not because we elected the best legislators, but because you know we've hearkened to this tradition that's been brought down to us. So we need laws, but we stop having new laws. I think one of the worst mistakes that our founding fathers made is the institution of the sitting legislature. I think that we ought to stick with a certain set of laws, and there are rarely needs to change them. And the only time you need to change them that I can see is when you have technological changes. So, for example, you know, it used to be to sign a contract, you needed pen and paper.
Right.
And in the modern world, people sign contracts all the time by clicking a mouse on their computer. Okay, laws did have to change to make that a legitimate contract.
Same too with privacy.
Sure.
You know, I mean, it was physical privacy before, going into your house.
Sure.
And now it's a telephone that you carry around that has data and documents on it.
And all my friends and all my communications.
Yeah, unfortunately, what we see a lot of, though, is the government passing laws that allow the government to control our ability to manage our own property.
Well, the government ends up, you know, pursuing its own interests,
right.
which is where we're kind of swinging into the next chapter here of what's wrong with democracy, is that when we were we had a simple concept of government, that the government is in charge, you know, that murder is against the law and robbery is against the law, and the job of the government is to catch the bad guys who break those fundamental laws and put them on trial and lock them up or whatever if necessary, and to defend the country against foreign invasion.
Right.
When that was the job of government, it was pretty straightforward.
Pretty simple.
It was simple, and all when the legislators voted to make murder illegal, they knew exactly what they were doing. It could not be clearer what they were voting for, and virtually all of the citizens, even I suspect most murderers, if you went to prison and interviewed the murderers, I suspect most murderers would agree that murder does need to be against the law. They may have wished they got away with their particular murder, but I think
agreed with the exception.
That's right. I don't think very many of them would say no murder should be legal. I really don't, because virtually everybody can agree with that. So when it was simple like that, democracy worked fairly well, okay? I'm no longer talking about what Hoppe says, I'm talking about what I'm saying. But then when we loaded it up with all the stuff where the government's deciding our health care and the government's deciding what we can do with our land and what we do with our house and our car and how my car has to be built and what its gas mileage has to be.
Bathroom bill.
And who gets to go use what bathroom. I mean, just when every single nook and cranny of everybody's life is going through government, and this is, we're now now on to what stuff Hayek says. But what Friedrich Hayek, the famous Austrian economist, says is that democracy falls apart in this because the legislators themselves cannot possibly understand this. The law against murder fit on one page. The law for Obamacare was 2,000 pages long. How many congressmen who voted for that had read those 2,000 pages?
Well, see, the thing is,
the answer is none of them.
But a lot of them did read it, even though they voted against it. They may have read it. The problem is, the law isn't the regulation. Yeah, so what's actually going to affect you is not technically the law. It's how it gets rolled out.
Because the law passes this law on to unelected bodies.
There
correct. Who figure out how to apply it. So you take a 2,000-page law and then put thousands of pages of regulation on top of that. So you're...
Yeah,
absolutely.
It's an exponential growth.
And another good example, by the way, is the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau law, which was passed.
Oh, hold that thought. Let's come back on that one.
That one's an utter disaster. And basically what the law does is put this guy in charge of this consumer who can't be removed for 10 years, no matter what, unless he does a crime. The only way to possibly remove him is to be impeached by Congress. And the law doesn't say these are the regulations. The law possibly says he's empowered to make whatever regulations he sees fit
to keep everyone safe.
That's where we fall apart. Let's hold that thought.
Okay, hold that thought.
We'll take a break.
Right back.
Want to talk about that because the bureaucracy is
and that's all that's up for debate right now. The Consumer Financial Protection
Act. And it should be
exactly. We'll be right back. Our guest is Lawrence Bevack. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That'd be the goal. Okay, back to the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. You were asking us where they got all their money.
Oh, I'm going to tell you where they get all their money, and it's amazing. They're not on budget. They do not have a budget that comes from the Congress like the Constitution says that Congress is supposed to appropriate all the money that's spent by the government.
Yes.
Okay. Well, they're not in Congress's budget at all, not in the least. Do you know where they get their money from? They get their money from the Federal Reserve. Do you know what that means? That means it gets printed just for them. The Federal Reserve doesn't have any of its own money. It just prints money.
Sure.
And so the freshly printed money pays for the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, which means that there is no congressional oversight over this at all. They have spent billions of dollars, this bureau, on themselves. And it was a congressman a couple months back who questioned the head of the bureau because he had spent $300 million renovating a building which cost $100 million.
Wow.
And you know what he said to the congressman?
Oh, God.
He said, are you ready what he said to the congressman?
Yeah,
he said, why do you care? That's not your money. We just see it gets printed for us by the Federal Reserve, okay? So we've got an agency here.
And when did these guys come in? This has been two years?
This was one of the first things that Obama... No, it's longer than that. This was one of the first things Obama did. This was back in those first 2 years of Obama when the Democrats controlled both houses of Congress before the Tea Party Revolution. This all happened in 2009 when Obama came in and like, well, we can't let these nasty capitalists, do all these crazy bad things to our economy anymore, so we need this new protection bureau. So what we've got here is an agency that spends billions of dollars completely off budget, and no one has any control over this at all because they basically literally have a license to print money. I mean, that's, when I was a kid, that was a joke. You know,
what
do you have a license to print money? Well,
right.
their answer is yes, we do.
They didn't even plant the tree to get it off.
we just print our own, whatever we need. And then you've got a guy in charge of it who has been empowered by the law basically to make up his own policy. The law doesn't say this is the policy that you're to enforce. See, the normal way it's supposed to work is that Congress makes a law and the enforcement agency enforces the law. But their law just says he decides. So
go keep consumers safe.
Yeah. So he just goes into whatever businesses and investors and stockbrokers are doing and decides what he likes and what he doesn't like and says, oh, I've decided that. And then finally, you can't get rid of him for 10 years because he can't be fired by anybody. And the only way to get rid of him is by impeachment, which means you have to impeach him in the House and have a trial in the Senate. And that's only for malfeasance. That's not for having really bad policies, okay? You have to, he has to commit a crime to be removed. If he just has the worst policies ever, you're stuck with him for 10 years. And I want you to understand, this is all a product of democracy. And this is exactly what Hayek predicts in The Road to Serfdom, that when government is not just catching murderers and protecting from foreign invasion, okay, when government's running everybody, the financial markets and the healthcare market, and it's in every corner of everybody's life and the environment and jobs and employment, everything else, that what happens is that congressmen cannot possibly understand all of these things and handle every circumstance, because as I already explained, it's too complicated. So what they tend to do, and it's a very bad tendency, but they do tend to do it, is to simply vote these powers onto unelected boards. So when we complain about, things like death panels and Obamacare, what people like Bernie Sanders would say is, but we're still a democracy. We're not like Venezuela or North Korea. We're a democracy, and if you're unhappy, you can voice it in the next election. But you can't, because the guy at the medical panel who is deciding whether you deserve that operation you need, but you know what? You look kind of old to me.
You've outlived your usefulness.
Yeah, that's right. I think you need to go home and die, right? and stop clogging up our medical system. The guy who says that to you, you can't vote for him. How are you supposed to, what are you supposed to do in the next election? And the answer is you can do nothing. To this bureaucrat, you are just a vassal. You are a peasant kneeling before the Duke and hoping for his favor, that he'll do what you want, and he has all the power. So what we're seeing here is that when you try to have a democracy, but you, at the same time, you're trying to have this whole socialist structure where they're running every detail of the country, it falls apart. And that's the first way that it falls apart. There's a second way that it falls apart also, which Hayek talks about, and that is that if you try, because the ultimate point here is you're making a plan for the entire country. You're deciding who gets what health care, who gets what job, who gets what money. Again, Sanders is very clear about this. He wants to, decide who, make sure you get a living wage, but you're not making too much. Okay, so if you have an economic plan that determines what everybody's doing, what everyone's going to get paid, how everyone's going to live their life, and how everything in the entire economy is going to function, what are the chances of getting an actual majority of the population to approve that plan? And the answer is zero, because the plan determines everybody's income and everybody's future. And everybody thinks that they should get paid more and that other people should get paid less. Okay?
Right.
Now, if all government's doing is making murder and robbery against the law, that's fine. Everyone agrees on that. But when the economic plan says this is how much money you're going to earn, and this is how much money that I'm going to earn, this is how much money he's going to earn, what is the chance of actually getting 51% of the voters to agree on something here? And the answer is zero. You can't possibly make everybody happy like that. If the government stays out of it and lets the free market decide what people get paid, people can actually live with that. I mean, they may not be thrilled, but if I go around looking, if I want to make $100,000 a year and I go looking around and nobody was willing to pay me $100,000 a year, at some point I'm going to conclude I'm really just not worth $100,000 a year, and I'm going to have to live with what the best offer I can get. But when government is deciding that you're only worth X number of dollars a year, you know, you're going to be as mad as a hornet. But putting together a new plan that'll make everybody happy is impossible because you're dividing resources. And so what Hayek says is this destroys democracy. And what eventually happens is that it turns into dictatorship. It turns into, you get a strong man in there. You know, Hitler got elected. Okay, you get a strong guy in there who says, darn it all, I got the plan and I'm just going to shove it down everybody's throat.
Sure.
Because, and this all began when you went down this path toward having government run all of these things as no business running.
So that's their democratic socialism that they talk about all the time?
Well, that's right. And
they make it sound like, no, that's the good socialism.
Yeah,
democratic socialism. That's
right.
That's the good socialism.
And that's exactly what Hayek is demonstrating doesn't work. Socialism destroys democracy because it tries to make it do too many things. It's mm-hmm. It can work in terms of just basic laws and things like that. But when you get into all this other stuff, it stops working. And you don't go to your congressman, you know, when they won't let you do what you want in your own backyard, or you're not getting the medical things you want, or the Consumer Protection Bureau is telling you what investments you can make and what you can't make, and your life is being micromanaged by all these people. Your congressman can't do anything about it. Because these are bureaucrats who are running this.
Well, we saw that a lot during the Obama administration.
Yeah.
And for the people that didn't intersect with government or bureaucracy during that time period, I mean, hooray for you. But for the people
they didn't think they were impacted by it because they never had an issue with it.
No. But for the people who did, when the members of Congress went to the bureaucrats, who are the executive branch, so now we have to have a little bit of civics, you know, people don't always focus on the civics, but, you know, we have three co-equal branches of government, ideally, and all the bureaucracy is in the executive branch. So when you have a guy like Obama who really doesn't follow the rule of law and doesn't intend to make anybody else do it either, the bureaucrats look at the elected people on the legislative side, and they just
thumb their nose at them,
give them the finger and keep walking.
Because they don't have any...
They know nothing will happen to them if they do the wrong thing.
And it's worth noting, if you're rich and powerful enough, you know, you can get through to some of the stuff. But it's funny because it's ironic because it's exactly the opposite of what the socialists want. The socialists, you know...
They want the rich people to be punished.
Yeah, that's right. But they get the exact opposite. Okay? The rich people, you know, can get their congressman on the phone. The rich people can get the head of, you know,
right,
whatever they
but
need
I guess
to get
my
on the phone.
Point is, under a bureaucracy that's running lawless, you can get your congressman on the phone all day long and he can't do a thing about it.
Sure.
They don't care.
But they don't enforce.
The poorer you are, the less likely you are to get any of these people to take you seriously. And it's funny because it's exactly the opposite. In capitalism, it actually makes the poor people, you know, not more powerful than the rich people, but gives the poor people more actual power than socialism does, because it gives them the power in the marketplace. You know, if you're going buying something at a store, they want you back there at that store. I mean, they value each and every customer.
Sure.
If I'm dissatisfied with something, you know, if I go to a restaurant, I don't like the meal, or if I go to Walmart and the product is not what I expect it to be, bend over backwards to try to make me happy. Okay, I've seen them go farther than I would have gone to make me happy. It's the minute you start complaining, it's incredibly clear how much they do not want you to go away mad. You go to your local death panel, your local, you know, Obamacare review board, and see how much they care about what. Go to the Registry of Motor Vehicles and see if they care whether you're going away happy or unhappy. Okay, they wouldn't care if you dropped dead right in the middle of their room, you know, until you started to stink.
But it's funny because if you look, you were saying that, I was thinking of McDonald's. I mean, you know, McDonald's is still, you know, relatively cheap. I would imagine they see a lower strata of income by and large,
sure,
just because people can afford it. And yet, what have they done? You know, they're making things like a cafe now, you know. They've really upgraded their image inside. They've added Playland. They've added all these things.
Well, they're trying to make their customers happy.
I mean, they're
because both on a larger scale and on an individual level.
Yeah.
If you complain, they will go to very significant lengths to make you happy.
Sure. Because in the long run, that's what pays their bills.
In the long run, that's what's in their interest. And it's just fascinating because it's exactly, it's like opposite land. Because the socialists think that the capitalists don't care about the little guy and that the socialist system will care about the little guy. And it's exactly 100% the opposite. And when we determine these things through democracy, what we're in effect doing is, there's, you know, 300 million plus people in the country, we're effectively making people less powerful instead of more powerful. Because even if, you know, I totally convince my congressman that the Obamacare bureaucrats are screwing me over, you know, can I get my congressman out of office? I mean, would that even if I could, would that help? Would that change the bureaucrat? Nope. I mean, I'm a million miles away from actually changing this.
Yeah. And the congressmen aren't in charge of the bureaucrats anyway. They have no direct supervision.
The congressman's not in charge of it. I probably couldn't by myself throw him out of office anyhow. Okay. I'm like miles away from actually accomplishing anything. Whereas in a capitalist system, it's exactly the opposite. You know, just try this. You know, complain at your local store, and you'll be amazed at the difference in the attitude you get there than you get, let's say, at the Registry of Motor Vehicles. And what all this whole socialist model is about getting us all into the Registry of Motor Vehicles.
Yeah. All right.
Good example. I don't care what state you live in. All right. Quick break to celebrate some capitalism, and we'll be right back with our guest, Lauren Spivak. You are listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us.
Sorry, I was sleeping.
Okay, 7 minutes or slightly more.
Make it all make sense.
Bring it home, Lauren.
I'll give you a little bit of history. The Atlantic Charter was a document signed by President Roosevelt and Winston Churchill on a battleship off the coast of Canada in 1940. And what they were, or maybe it was 41, what they were endeavoring to do was to explain what World War II was about. It was basically a charter of war aims. We are going to war, we're fighting the Germans and the Japanese to achieve what? And they made a list of goals, and one of them, and probably the most famous one, is they said the right of all people to choose the government under which they live. And I read that and I said, well, I guess they failed. Because I don't get to choose the government under which I live. And I wondered about that, but I realized they had just slightly misworded it. What they meant to say is the right to choose the government under which you live if you're in the majority. Okay? Then you get the right to choose the government under which you live. If you're not in the majority, you get nothing.
You're out. You get what you get.
You get nothing. And what I would like to have is a system where individual people have rights. I think that the, you know, majorities oppress minorities. And it's particularly amusing when leftists, you know, think that democracy is the solution to everything. Because, you know, I point out to them that, you know, the majority of the people of the country, you know, are white, you know, are Christian, are things that, you know, the left doesn't particularly like. And historically, majorities have always oppressed minorities. That's what they do. Mm-hmm. That's pretty much the hobby of all majorities everywhere,
sure,
is to kick the minority around. So what I think is far, far more important than the rights of majorities, which really don't have to be protected because they're the majority, is the rights of individuals. That is what makes America special, is not majority rule, but minority rights. And the fundamental right of rights of the individual, you know, include some things that are clearly in the Constitution, like free speech and freedom of religion. You know, do you want the majority to decide that? I don't think so. But it also also includes the right to decide what to do with your own property, the right to keep the fruit of your own labor, the right to pursue your own political goals and communicate your ideas to your fellow citizens. And this stuff is what we ought to turn to. And we've kind of been pulled away from this by this siren song of democracy, where people, you know, can vote for candidates they like. They're, you know, the guy is handsome, he's articulate, he talks really well into a camera. But we've gotten very far away from what actually makes a wise governing policies. And so the two-pronged approach to what where wisdom really comes from, and by the way, you know, we talked at one point about my first seminar. My third seminar is called The Search for Superhuman Wisdom, and it's all about this. And there's two answers to that. One is on an individual level, we have far more wisdom that individuals have about their own life, their own property, their own family than the government does. We talked about that. Mm-hmm. The second one is that we are the heirs of some really, really great Republican with a small r ideas. And that tells us that a few small things have to be against the law, and that there's fundamental rights in terms of the criminal justice system and the presumption of innocence and trial by jury. And by the way, those are dying before democracy also. The fact that we can try people twice for the same crime, if the federal government tries them and the state government tries them, I don't know if you're into civil asset forfeiture, but the, you know, government's now taking away people's, you know, property without any trial, any court at all. So these things are falling by the wayside because of ideas that, you know, you can sell to the voting populace, but are detrimental to our fundamental human rights. And so my solution to what's better than having democracy side things is, one is to hang on to those traditions that have made us a free people all this time, and second of all, to live to make the day-to-day decisions in the hands of the individual people, as opposed to trying to centralize it by some authority, even if some temporary, you know, majority, and majorities come and go with the wind, you know, happens to support it at this moment.
Yeah, and we've actually turned to the exact opposite. I mean, we're doing the opposite right now.
That's right.
We're letting, you know, centralized or non-centralized government tell us what to do.
But how the left is dealing with the minority, right, regardless of what kind it is, whether it's a race or a religion or whatever, they want them to have special rights. So instead of individual rights covering everybody,
group rights,
now we want this weird centralized everything. And 2 minutes. We all have to stop talking so we can look at the clock and know we have 2 minutes. Instead, now we have to have special rights now. So everyone's little private thing
has to be
enshrined.
We don't all operate under the same set of rules
anymore. And that, I would imagine,
that's a dangerous road.
The left wants a lot of things that are very illogical. The last time I was in an argument with a socialist, he was saying that how we distribute all the money in the country should be decided by democracy. And I said, don't you understand that the majority oppresses the minority? And he said, well, we'll make laws to protect the minority.
I said,
who's making laws to protect the minority? The majority? Who makes the laws to protect the minority? Okay? Under his system, the majority. We're like chasing our tail.
Yep. It's mob rule.
You either base your society first and foremost on the fundamental rights of individuals, or you are endlessly at the mercy of temporary majorities waxing and waning from day to day.
What a mess.
And they're no wiser than anybody else.
Bad road to travel. Yeah. Tell people how they can get a hold of you, because you teach.
Sure, my
no
website.
Charge.
My website. You can see about my books, but you can also contact me. Is drtruthbooks.com, which is drtruthbooks, all one word, .com.
Great.
Perfect. And they can find your email and all that, request that you come speak to their group or do one of your seminars. You have three seminars.
I do.
Fantastic.
All right. Well, thank you, Lauren.
Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure.
It's been a ball.
You're the best show on the radio. Always happy to be here.
Okay, love it. I'll slip you the 20.
We could go down any rabbit hole with you. Thanks a million.